Hey, 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 you better watch out, Yogi. Here comes Mr. Ranger, and he's wearing a gun.
Good evening, folks. You're listening to the Hour of the Time, and I'm still William Cooper. The White House issued a press release from the Office of the Press Secretary dated April 25th, 1999. Entitled Remarks by the President at the Close of the Washington Summit, International Trade Center, 4:25 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. In his remarks, he said this, and I quote, "There has been this breathtaking explosion of freedom, but the old order has not yet been replaced by a new one." Now, like of all you've been hearing on this broadcast, you have to understand that he's talking about the new world order. World totalitarian socialist government. He refers to it by many different names. Encoded, if you will, but still he refers to it sometimes as the new dawn. The destiny of America and a whole bunch of other Illuminati buzzwords. Ladies and gentlemen, you need to start paying very close attention to what's going on in this world. You're going to see an increasing wave of senseless violence. And if that doesn't work to take the guns out of the hands of the American people, well, something more tragic than you ever dreamed of will happen, such as the detonation of an atomic weapon in one of our major cities. Don't think they won't do it. They will. And they'll prepare you first. They'll say that it's some terrorist group that's stolen a weapon or acquired an atomic weapon or built an atomic weapon. Please, you had better wake up while we can still do something about this. And watch, it will come to pass. Make sure you have pen and paper by your side, folks, and be prepared to take copious notes as we continue sourcing and documenting the treason that has occurred over the years in this country to destroy the United States of America and bring about a one-world totalitarian socialist government.
Oh, dear sheeple, if you only knew, if I could just shake you and wake you up, if I could just do something to make you understand what it is that we're losing. If we were given a hand in this, if we were allowed to participate and debate and help form what is coming, we might be able to create something good. Just the fact that it is being brought about through lies and deception and manipulation, and the death of many, many good people around the world, tells me that there's nothing good about it. In fact, it smells so bad, I can smell the stench right here in our studios, under the clear, beautiful blue Arizona skies. It's rotten. The people who are bringing about it are liars and deceivers. They are rotten. Remember, Jesus Christ is the truth, the way, and the life. There is a God, and it is God that you should pray to. Lucifer, Satan, is the great deceiver. Anything born from so many lies and so much deception and so much manipulation is born of Lucifer. I hope you understand what I'm telling you. We're engaged in a war, ladies and gentlemen. a physical, material war and a spiritual war. And you must, at this time, take sides. You cannot wait any longer. You must take sides. We are at the fork in the road.
You've got to get all this stuff out to you, folks. Tonight, I'm going to cover a lot of things. I'm going to start off with the second annual report to Congress, January 1st, 1962, December the 31st, 1962. It's the second annual report to Congress from the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. It's United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, Publication 14, released February 1963. So pay attention, folks. You need to know all of this. And, okay, I'm going to read from page 10 of this report. The United States plan also provides for the reduction of forces of the United States and the Soviet Union to 2.1 million in Stage 1 and 1.05 million in Stage 2, with corresponding reductions by other nations. Stage 1 of the U.S. plan contains essential measures to meet the nuclear threat, especially by a cutoff of the production of fissionable materials for nuclear weapons purposes. Further measures to reduce and eventually eliminate nuclear weapons remaining in national arsenals would be carried out in Stages 2 and 3 of the United States program after the completion of international expert studies. The United States proposes completion of Stages 1 and 2 in 3 years each and Stage 3 as soon as possible. Now, they never did stick to their 3 years. It took them a lot longer than that for both Stages 1. We are in Stage 2 right now. According to the timetable, we have one more year in Stage 2, and then it goes to Stage 3. Now, remember, these are actual documents, folks, that you can look up yourself. I've been reading directly from actual United States government documents since the early show last Thursday. This is the fifth hour of broadcast of these documents, which reveal that our government, the one that calls itself our government, is in fact illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional, treasonous, and is destroying this nation from within to bring about a one-world totalitarian socialist government under the United Nations. It is not conjecture. It is not Looney Tunes. It's not prophecy, as Mr. Kurt Sasson deems it. It is fact, and it's coming to you right out of these documents that prove it beyond any shadow of any doubt. And by the way, folks, if you see a black helicopter flying in your area, don't report it to us, because according to Kurt Sasson, it's only a UFO. I'll tell you, I never laughed so hard in my life as I did during the last hour listening to Kurt Sasson. But I helped him get on radio because he does teach you how to store food, teaches you how to defend yourself, and a few other things. But, folks, you better be listening with the right ear when you listen to that man and all these other people, too. He was, in fact, one of the first founding members of the Satanic Church in America. He was, in fact, as he said, kicked out of the John Birch Society because he was subversive. Ladies and gentlemen, that man is not on our side. According to his own broadcast, as soon as they get rid of all the people who should never have been born, then this is going to be a better world. Instead of calling in and asking the questions that you do, why don't you call in and ask him who those people are? Who's he talking about? You might find out that you're on his list. Then again, you might find out it's somebody else. Might be all the black people, or all the red people, or all the Chinese people. I guarantee it's somebody that doesn't look like him. I guarantee you that. I continue. Ladies and gentlemen, provision is also made for appropriate inspection and verification at all stages. Adequate assurance must be provided not only as to arms destroyed, but also as to permitted levels of retained arms. It is not anticipated that verification would have to be excessive to be effective, but its intensity would be commensurate with the specific disarmament measure under consideration. The United States has suggested a progressive zonal system of inspection as a possible way of assuring observance of the treaty. Now, if you recently purchased a box of Kix and looked on the back of it, you saw the regions that the United States has been divided up into. They are teaching the children, forth. Most parents don't pay any attention to what's on a cereal box, nor what children watch on television, nor what children watch in their movies and videos. So, of course, most of you parents don't even know that. The United States plan further proposes the establishment of an international disarmament organization within the United Nations framework. It also contains specific provisions for a prohibition against placing weapons of mass destruction in outer space, the institution of measures aiming at reducing the risk of war which could be initiated prior to the conclusion of an overall disarmament treaty, and the strengthening of peacekeeping arrangements through improved procedures for peaceful settlements of disputes and the eventual establishment of an international peace force. Now, I'm sure even the most stupid listener out there can understand that if the United Nations has a peacekeeping force, then the United Nations is the boss, and that the United States has no sovereignty, and in fact will be subject to the United Nations. The truth is, folks, it happened years ago. The United Nations and the United States of America are one and the same. The United States, the United Nations, and the Soviet Union are one and the same. Make you angry? Good. I hope you have a fit of apoplexy. I hope it makes you run out and get these documents so that you can confirm it for yourself instead of sitting there and fuming and blustering. A lot of archy bunkers in this world, folks. Don't confuse me with the facts. I already know what I believe. Isn't that right? Okay, here we go. In contrast, the Soviet plan places emphasis on reducing selected categories of armaments in each of its three stages. See, their plan has three stages also. Accordingly, the Soviet draft treaty initially sought a 100% reduction in nuclear delivery vehicles in Stage 1, although the nuclear weapons themselves would not be eliminated until Stage 2. The Soviet plan was more restrictive than ours, ladies and gentlemen. They wanted to come to one world government first, because in the entire history of the socialist movement, their goal has never been hidden, and it's always been one world government, a democratic socialist state. Democracy and socialism are the same word with the same meanings, as you will find out as you continue to listen to the hour of the time. I'm going to skip over to page 11, I believe it is. However, the overall Soviet approach remains substantially the same as the United States plan, and that even in the light of this shift, it is inadequate in terms of preserving the existing relative military balance. This remains a subject for further exploration. The Soviet Union later agreed, however, to a percentage reduction of conventional armaments, coupled with the almost complete elimination of delivery means in Stage 1. It also insists on the abolition of all foreign military bases and the withdrawal of all foreign troops from abroad. On the matter of force levels, the Soviet Union originally proposed Stage 1 levels of 1.7 million for the United States and the Soviet Union and Stage 2 levels of 1 million, although later expressing a willingness to accept a level of 1.9 million for Stage 1. The Soviet position on verification calls only for arrangements to verify the destruction of agreed numbers of armaments. It makes no provision for a check of remaining levels to determine, for example, whether weapons have been secretly hidden. According to the initial Soviet plan, all three stages were to occur over a four-year period, with Stage 1 being carried out in 21 months. The overall time period was subsequently extended to 5 years, with Stage 1 extended to 2 years. Although the Soviet plan also advocates reliance upon a strengthened United Nations to maintain peace. You see, folks? This is back, way back there, ladies and gentlemen. This was written, remember, 1963. One year after the documents that I read to you last Friday. A key task involved backstopping the United States delegation to the 18-nation disarmament committee meetings in Geneva beginning in March 1962, including detail of secretariat personnel to the United States delegation secretariat, communications and documentation to and from Geneva, and liaison with the Department of State's Office of International Conferences on Administrative and Personnel Arrangements for the delegation. Under reference research staff, from page 45, Another prominent activity of this staff arises from Executive Order Number 11044 on Interagency Coordination of Arms Control and Disarmament Matters. See Appendix 1. Under this order, the Director of ACDA is responsible for planning and developing a program of government research and studies on arms control and disarmament policy. The order enjoins him to maintain a continuing inventory of government research activities and to submit to parties to the treaty and other transition requirements have been satisfied. And from that point on, it is a carbon copy of the blueprint for the peace race presented to the United Nations by President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Nothing was changed. And I remind you that under Stage 2, paragraph 2, subparagraph 8, specify types of small arms, declarations by types, which is happening right now, and specified categories of ammunition for armaments listed in Stage 1, Section A, subparagraph 1B, and subparagraph B above would be reduced to levels consistent with the levels of armaments agreed for the end of Stage 2. And they're not talking, ladies and gentlemen, about military armaments there. Go to page 82, general provisions applicable to all stages. And under paragraph 2 in the interim agreement, it talks about a preparatory commission. And paragraph 3, subparagraph C, the treaty would come into force when it had been ratified by blank number of states which had not been agreed upon at this time, including the United States of America, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and an agreed number of the following states. Again, that's left blank because it had not been agreed upon at that particular point. D, in order to assure the achievement of the fundamental purpose of a permanent state of general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world, the treaty would specify that the accession of certain military significant sites would be essential for the continued effectiveness of the treaty or for the coming into force of particular measures or stages. Notice, folks, how they keep referring to disarmament in a peaceful world. There has been no peaceful world in the history of the world. The world is not at peace now, and we continue to disarm. E, the parties of the treaty would undertake to exert every effort to induce other states or authorities to accede to the treaty. F, the treaty would be subject to ratification or acceptance in accordance with constitutional processes. Now, folks, remember, they're talking about all the nations of the world, most of whom don't have a constitutional process. Thereby, when they say constitutional process, that's meant to fool Americans into thinking it's going to be done by our Constitution. It's not true. It will be done according to the United Nations Charter, the United Nations Treaty, and the resolutions passed by the General Assembly of the United Nations. And none of it is a constitutional process. G, a depository government would be agreed upon which would have all of the duties normally incumbent upon a depository. Alternatively, the United Nations would be the depository. Now listen to that carefully, folks. I'm going to read it to you again. Here they say that the United Nations will be the depository government of the world, which will oversee and have all of the duties normally incumbent upon such a government. I'm going to read it to you again. G, a depository government would be agreed upon which would have all of the duties normally incumbent upon a depository. Alternatively, the United Nations would be the depository. Welcome to the real world, sheeple. It's about time you left the theme park and came out into the real world. The gates are closing. Your e-ticket is no good anymore. So even if the rides kept going around, they're not going to take your ticket. I now have here Public Law 101-216. Public Law 101-216 from the United States Code, Congressional and Administrative News, Volume 2, R347, 1989, V.2, whatever that means. Public Law 101-216. It was H.R. or House Resolution 1495, December the 11th, 1989. So if you're sitting there thinking, Cooper's reading all this old stuff that they never implemented and he's trying to scare us, listen to this, sheeple. Listen to this, Archie Bunker. Listen to this, all you good people who have already awakened and just need the ammunition to be able to fight. I'm giving it to you now. Public Law 101-216, which was H.R. 1495, December the 11th, 1989. Arms Control and Disarmament Amendments Act of 1989. So this isn't a new act, ladies and gentlemen. These are disarmament amendments of the original law that I've been reading to you. For legislative history of the Act, see page 1292, and on that page it recounts everything that you've heard from me since Thursday. So I'm going to go directly to these amendments. An Act to amend the Arms Control and Disarmament Act to authorize appropriations for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and for other purposes. Being enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled. Section 1, short title. This act may be cited as the Arms Control and Disarmament Amendments Act of 1989. Title 1, Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Section 101, Authorization of Appropriations for Fiscal Year 1988. Section 49A of the Arms Control and Disarmament Act is amended to read as follows. Section 49A, to carry out the purposes of this act, there are authorized to be appropriated A, $36 million for the fiscal year 1990, and $37,316,000 for the fiscal year 1991, and B, and this is the key, such additional amounts as may be necessary for fiscal years 1990 and 1991 for increases in salary, pay, retirement, other employee benefits authorized by law, and other, quote, non-discretionary costs, unquote, and to offset adverse fluctuations in foreign currency exchange rates. How do you like that? And these monies are not disclosed. Section 102, duties of the deputy director. Go down to Section 103, duties of the special representatives. A, in general, Section 27 of the Arms Control and Disarmament Act, 22 United States Code 2567, is amended by striking out, quote, who shall perform, unquote, and all that follows through the period and inserting in lieu thereof the following, quote, one of whom should serve as special representative for conventional arms control negotiations, and the other should serve as special representative and chief science advisor to the director. The two special representatives shall perform their duties and exercise their powers under the direction of the president and the secretary of state, acting through the director. Now we go over to, excuse me, folks, we go over to Public Law 101-216, Laws of the 101st Congress, First Session, December the 11th, and I quote verbatim, the Director of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency should study and report to the Congress on the advisability of establishing in the agency an Arms Control Implementation and Compliance Resolution Bureau or other organizational unit that would be responsible for, number one, managing the implementation of existing and future arms control agreements, two, coordinating the activities of the Special Verification Commission and the Standing Consultative Commission, and three, preparing comprehensive analysis and policy positions regarding the effective resolution of arms control compliance questions. Section 105, Arms Control Verification. Establishment of working group. The president should establish a working group, one, to examine verification approaches to a strategic arms reduction agreement and other arms control agreements, and two, to assess the relevance of such agreements of the verification provisions of the treaty between the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics on the, quote, elimination of their intermediate-range and short-range missiles, signed at Washington, December 8, 1987, unquote. Go down to B, subparagraph B, proposed, prospective, and potential bilateral or multilateral arms treaties in the areas of nuclear, conventional, chemical, and space weapons. 2. The agency shall seek to improve United States verification and monitoring activities through the monitoring and support of relevant research and analysis. And 3, the agency shall provide detailed information on the activities pursuant to this section in its annual report to the Congress. Don't go away, folks. I'll be right back after this very short break. You have a pad of paper and pen with you, folks, because we're going to continue. And I go down to section 107, reporting requirement on prospects for conversion of United States defense industries. Now, did you hear me, ladies and gentlemen? Section 107, reporting requirement on prospects for conversion of United States defense industries. The director of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, in consultation with the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Commerce, shall study, and not later than 180 days after the date of enactment of this act, submit to the Congress a report on concrete steps which could be taken to improve prospects for conversion of United States defense industries to non-defense related activities as opportunities are presented through the achievement of successful arms control agreements. Title II, on-site inspection activities. And this will verify a lot. The Arms Control and Disarmament Act is amended by adding at the end the following. Title V, on-site inspection activities. Section 61, findings. The Congress finds that, 1. Under this Act, the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency is charged with the formulation and implementation of United States Arms Control and Disarmament Policy in a manner which will promote the national security. That, folks, is a laugh. Number 2. As defined in this Act, the terms arms control and disarmament mean, quote, the identification, verification, inspection, limitation, control, reduction, and elimination of armed forces and armaments of all kinds under international agreement to establish an effective system of international control. International control. International control. International control. 3. The On-Site Inspection Agency was established in 1988 pursuant to the INF Treaty to implement on behalf of the United States the inspection provisions of the INF Treaty. 4. On-site inspection activities under the INF Treaty include Subsection A. Inspections in the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia, and the German Democratic Republic. B. Escort duties for Soviet teams visiting the United States and the basing countries. C. Establishment and operation of the portal monitoring facility in the Soviet Union. And D. Listen to this very carefully, sheeple. Support for the Soviet inspectors at the portal monitoring facility in Utah.
And that brings up another subject. There is a prophecy in the Mormon Church that at some future date, when the Constitution for the United States of America is hanging by a thread, the Mormon Church will come forward to save it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's not just hanging by a thread. According to the law, according to the treaties, according to the United Nations Charter and the UN Participation Act, according to the actions of William Jefferson Clinton and the government of the United States of America, it's already in the trash can. My question is, where
is the Mormon Church.
D, listen to this very carefully, sheeple. Support for the Soviet inspectors at the portal monitoring facility in Utah. Support for the Soviet inspectors at the portal monitoring facility in Utah. 5. The personnel of the on-site inspection agency includes civilian technical experts, civilian support personnel, and members of the armed forces. And I go now to Public Law 101-216, to Section 63, Authorizations of Appropriations for On-Site Inspection Agency. They are authorized to be appropriated $49,830,000 for fiscal year 1990 and $48,831,000 for fiscal year 1991 for the expenses of the On-Site Inspection Agency in carrying out on-site inspection activities pursuant to the INF Treaty. Section 64 definitions as used in this title. The term INF Treaty means the treaty between the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics on the elimination of their intermediate range and shorter range missiles signed at Washington December 8, 1987. And two, the term OSIA means the on-site inspection agency established by the president or such other agency as may be designated by the president to carry out the on-site inspection provisions of the INF Treaty approved December the 11th, 1989. Act cited by popular name. This is from the United States Code 1988, Supplement 3, Popular Names. Index. Arms Control and Disarmament Act. Public Law 101-216. Title 1, Subsection 101-103A. 106, Title 2, Subsection 201, December 11, 1989. 103 Statutes at Large, 1853 to 1855. Public Law 102-228. Title 4, Subsection 401A, B, 402, December 12, 1991, 105 statutes at large, 1698 and 1699. The Arms Control Disarmament Act, Public Law 87-297, September 26, 1961, 75 statutes at law, 631, Title 22, Subsection 2551, et sequitur. Public Law 88-186, November 26, 1963, 77 statutes at large, 3441. Public Law 88-426, Title 3, Subsection 305-17, August 14, 1964, 78 statutes at large, 424. Public Law 88-448, Title 4, Subsection 401D, August 19, 1964, 78 statutes at large, 490. Public Law 89-27, May 27, 1965, 79 statutes at large, 118. Public Law 90-314, May 23, 1968, 82 statutes at large, 129. Public Law 91-246, May 12, 1970, 84 statutes at large, 207. Public Law 92-352, Title 3, Subsection 301, July 13, 1972, 86 statutes at large, 494. Public Law 94-141, Title 1, Subsection 141, 144 through 149, November 29, 1975, 89 statutes at large, 757-760. Public Law 95-108, Subsection 2, Paragraph A, 3-6, August 17, 1977, 91 statutes at large, 871 through 873. Public Law 95-338, subsection 1-3, August 8, 1978, 92 statutes at large, 458 and 459. Public Law 96-66, subsection 1-2, Paragraph A, September 21st, 1979, 93 Statutes at Large 414, Public Law 96-465, Title 2, Subsection 2204, October 17, 1980, 94 Statutes at Large 2159. Public Law 97-339, Subsection 2, A, 3, and 4, October 15, 1982, 96 Statutes at Large, 1635 and 1636. Public Law 98-202, Subsection 1 through 6, A, December 2, 1983, 97 Statutes at Large, 1381 and 1382. Public Law 99-93, Title 7, Subsection 701-703, August 16, 1985, 99 Statutes at Large, 444 and 445. Public Law 99-550, Section 2, C, October 27, 1986, 100 Statutes at Large, 3070. Public Law 100-213, Subsection 2 and 3B and 4 and 6A, December 24, 1987, 101 Statutes at Large, 1444 through 1446. In there you will find that they took out, ladies and gentlemen, the portion which stated that no section of this treaty would be considered a requirement to disarm the American people. It is no longer in there. And they are, in fact, doing it. You cannot have a treaty that specifies complete and total disarmament if somebody's going to be still keeping their arms. It's gone. It's not there. Now I go to the Congressional Record of the House of Representatives, October 12, 1989, H7007. Listen carefully. The chairman. Are there further amendments to the amendment in the nature of a substitute? If not, the question is on the amendment in the nature of a substitute offered by the gentleman from Florida, Mr. Faschel, as amended. The amendment in the nature of a substitute as amended was agreed to. The chairman, under the rule, the committee rises. Accordingly, the committee rose, and the speaker pro temp, Mr. Neal of Massachusetts, having assumed the chair, Mr. Coleman of Texas, chairman of the committee of the whole House of the State of the Union, reported that the committee, having had under consideration the bill, H.R. 1495, to amend the Arms Control and Disarmament Act to authorize appropriations for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and for other purposes pursuant to House Resolution 255. He reported the bill back to the committee of the whole. The speaker pro temp, under the rule, the previous question is ordered. The question is on the amendment. The amendment was agreed to. The speaker pro temp, the question is on the engrossment and third reading of the bill. The bill was ordered to be engrossed and read a third time and was read the third time. The speaker pro temp, the question is on the passage of the bill. The question was taken, and the speaker pro temp announced that the ayes appeared to have it. Mr. Broomfield. Mr. Speaker, I object to the vote on the ground that a quorum is not present and make the point of order that a quorum is not present. The Speaker pro temp. Evidently, a quorum is not present. The Sergeant at Arms will notify absent members. The vote was taken by electronic device, and there were yeas 400, nays 11, not voting 21. All the names of who voted on this bill in the original Disarmament and Control Act is in this documentation of papers also. And now I go to the Congressional Record of the Senate. The Senate, November 17, 1989. Mr. Pell, Mr. President, I strongly commend to the Senate this measure now before this body, the Arms Control and Disarmament Amendments Act of 1989. The amendment being offered today contains the mutually acceptable provisions of both the House Bill, H.R. 1495, and an original bill, S. or Senate, 1868, reported on November 9th by the Committee on Foreign Relations. And it goes through all this gobbledygook until we get to what's important here. And it talks about the committee is concerned about the sharp reduction of resources devoted to research on verification issues and wishes to make certain that verification and compliance are accorded the attention which will be necessary in the years ahead as intensive and complex verification proposals are agreed upon and implemented accordingly. The armament of the amendment incorporates a House provision urging the President to establish a working group to examine various verification approaches to strategic arms reduction and other possible agreements, and to assess the relevance for such agreement of the verification provision of the International Nuclear Forces Treaty. Moreover, the amendment contains a provision proposed by the Senator from Massachusetts, Mr. Kerry, calling upon the agency to allocate sufficient resources to develop and maintain a comprehensive information and database on verification concepts, research, technologies, and systems. And we go down. The amendment also incorporates provisions on on-site inspection activities, and the appropriation authorized is $49,830,000 for fiscal year 1990 and $48,831,000 for fiscal year 1991 for the expenses of the on-site inspection agency in carrying out on-site inspection activities pursuant to the INF Treaty. Finally, this committee bill includes a provision completely acceptable to both sides offered by the Senator from Illinois, Mr. Simon, which calls upon the director of the agency to report to the Congress within 180 days on concrete steps which could be taken to improve prospects for conversion of significant portions of the United States defense industries to non-defense related activities as opportunities are presented through the achievement of successful arms control agreements. Excuse me, folks, I gotta take a little drink here. Mr. President, I believe that this amendment provides a reasonable and practical level of authorization. It will ensure that the agency is able to perform its expanding duties in a manner that will bring credit to the United States. Other provisions in this legislation will help ensure that ACDA focuses on the areas of greatest need and will do so with improved management and structure. Mr. Helms. Mr. President, I have a few points to make about the fiscal year 1990 authorization bill for the Arms Agency, but before I make these points, I congratulate my distinguished colleague, the chairman, Senator Pell, for his diligence and leadership in the Foreign Relations Committee's work on this important bill. Senator Pell and I, together with our professional staffs, have cooperated on a spirit of friendship and comity on this bill. That's Jesse Helms and Senator Pell, Claiborne Pell. Mr. President, I would make 3 points at the outset. Number one, in my priority, for the first time, the bill assigns specific duties to improve security at ACDA to the Deputy Director of ACDA. The ACDA Deputy Director is now assigned specific responsibility for managing the important areas of security and administration. This provision was put in the bill in order to correct the serious security problems that were discovered during the 1983-87 period at ACDA headquarters and at the Geneva negotiations. These security problems were so serious that they required new management at ACDA and direct attention at the highest management level. Second, the bill gives the two special representatives for arms control and disarmament negotiations specific assignments in, quote, discrete areas, unquote. For example, one ACDA special representative is now assigned specific responsibilities for the high priority area of conventional arms negotiations. Under the heading of conventional arms, under the definitions attached to the bill, is your weapons, ladies and gentlemen. The amendment number 1171 was agreed to. The bill H.R. 1495, as amended, was read the third time and passed. Congressional Record Senate. March 1st. Under disarmament, Mr. Clark. Mr. President, I now desire to speak for a few minutes on the subject of disarmament, the climate toward disarmament in the Senate and in the country, and the prospects for disarmament in the coming conference at Geneva, which convenes on March 14th of this year. Mr. President, the morning newspapers carry the statement that the President is about to authorize the resumption of nuclear testing in the atmosphere. If he does this, I shall support him because I am confident that he has carefully weighed, on the basis of information not available to me or to most of my colleagues, the basic facts involved in that fateful decision. I am also confident he would not and will not take this tragic step unless he is convinced it is the only wise way to maintain our national security and our freedom. If atmospheric nuclear testing is to be resumed, obviously there is merit to making the decision before the disarmament conference meets. When it is the darkest, it is frequently just before the dawn. When it is the darkest, it is frequently just before the dawn. In business, in the law, and in other instances, when men came together to negotiate, frequently the break or the agreement comes at a time when things seem most hopeless, at a time when both sides are of the view that no progress is possible, but each is determined to make one more effort to achieve a mutually desired result. Mr. President, I suggest that we should look forward to the disarmament conference in the hope that something meaningful can come out of it. In considering that conference, we must give some thought to what is the position of the government of the United States. I think that position has been substantially misunderstood, both in the country and in the Congress. One reason for my so thinking arises from a relatively short insertion in the record made by my good friend, the junior senator from Texas, Mr. Tower, on January 29th of this year, which appears in the record at page 1043. Look it up, folks. I ask unanimous consent, Mr. President, that my colleague's comments and a column which he introduced into the record at that point, written by a man named Ken Thompson, published in a Dallas newspaper entitled, quote, 1-2-3 Surrender, unquote, may be printed in the record at this point in my remarks. There being no objection, the excerpt was ordered to be printed in the records and as follows. The Surrender of American Rights and Sovereignty. Mr. Tower, Mr. President, will the Senator yield? Mr. Mansfield, I yield. Mr. Tower, every day more and more people share a growing concern for the preoccupation of the State Department and some people in high places with the issue of disarmament. I think we all look forward to the day when men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. But at a time when Western civilization is confronted by an extreme militaristic threat looking toward world conquest, I think it is naive and unrealistic to be preoccupied with the question of disarmament. We know that the communist conspiracy has no intention of coexisting with us. We know that they are bent on domination of the whole world. I think we show weakness in the eyes of all of the nations at this time in talking of disarmament. In this connection, I ask to have printed in the record a very fine editorial entitled, quote, 1-2-3 Surrender, unquote, by Ken Thompson, editorial staff writer, published in the Dallas Morning News of January 23, 1962. There being no objection, the editorial was ordered to be printed in the record as follows. 1-2-3 Surrender by Ken Thompson. One of the most incredible documents ever to emerge from the foggy corridors of the State Department is a bulletin entitled, quote, Freedom from War, the United States Program for General and Complete Disarmament in a Peaceful World, unquote. Those of you who thought that William Cooper made this all up, now you know I didn't. In fact, all of these will be made available to you. We are in the process of making arrangements to publish everything. As skeptical as I have always been of the measure of good sense and loyalty within the State Department, I never would have believed that these people we call our diplomats could so completely and unabashedly advocate the surrender of American rights and sovereignty until this bulletin appeared. What it amounts to, in effect, is the official United States position on the subject of disarmament. More specifically, it is the basis of proposals which have already been submitted to the United Nations by the United States. Although this bulletin was published last fall and is available for just 15 cents from the government printing office in Washington, there has been very little attention paid to it. Now remember, folks, it was printed in 1962. Why, I cannot tell you, for it is certainly the most fantastic harebrained blueprint for surrender on record. Old Nikita himself might just as well have written it, And if more of the American people knew about this scheme, there would be a nationwide uproar that would make the reaction to the Alger Hiss scandal look like another era of good feeling by comparison. For those of you who don't know, Alger Hiss was a communist, who had infiltrated our government at high levels, and it was Alger Hiss himself, sent by the President of the United States, who wrote the United Nations Charter. It was Alger Hiss who is mainly responsible for the formation of the UN in the form that it has taken. And it is Alger Hiss who is responsible for convincing the President and his advisors to go along with the whole scheme, ladies and gentlemen. Communist. Now, if you've been reading the liberal press, now that the socialists and communists are in charge, you know that there is a move afoot to exonerate Alger Hiss. To exonerate him. I continue. Last September, President Kennedy addressed the United Nations and spoke of the desire of the United States to reach an agreement on disarmament. His stand has been echoed by Adlai Stevenson, our chief delegate and ambassador to the United Nations. Where Kennedy and Stevenson spoke in general terms, the State Department bulletin deals in specifics. It supplies the term for those vague goals the administration hopes to gain through the United Nations. What are these terms? The State Department document summarizes the proposals as a new program which provides for the progressive reduction of war-making capabilities of nations and the simultaneous strengthening of international institutions to settle disputes and maintain the peace. This program is broken down into three phases or parts. In the first phase, all nuclear weapons tests by nations would be prohibited, production of fissionable materials stopped, strategic delivery systems reduced, and conventional arms and armed forces would be cut. In the second phase, present stocks of nuclear weapons would be reduced, further cuts would be made in armed forces, armaments and delivery systems, and military bases and facilities would be dismantled. At the same time, a peace force would be established for the United Nations. In the third and final phase, all nations would possess only those forces, non-nuclear armaments, and establishments required for the purpose of maintaining internal order. They would also support and provide agreed manpower for the United Nations Peace Force. This force would be fully functioning and would be sufficiently strong to overpower any individual nation or combination of nations resisting its will. Now I'm going to read that again for all you silly, stupid people out there who think that this is funny. This force would be fully functioning and would be sufficiently strong to overcome any individual nation or combination of nations resisting its will. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. 1, 2, 3, bingo! The United Nations rules the world. Counterfeit government, which calls itself the government of the United States of America, is not, I repeat, I renounce it, I expose them. They are illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional, and are in fact not the constitutional government of the United States of America, and have not been for a long, long time, and we are proving it on this program. We are proving the treason, their long history throughout the ages. what they have done in the law to subvert and destroy this nation and bring about their one-world totalitarian socialist, in their own words, ladies and gentlemen, in their own words. I wrote about all this in my book as I first began to open my eyes and discover what was happening when I was a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence many years ago. After over 20 years of research, I wrote a book. In this book, I outlined everything that I had discovered and eventually began broadcasting on May the 4th, 1992, the hour of the time. Many people began to listen to this program in disbelief, set out to prove me wrong, and found the documentation that I stated to be, in fact, in existence, to be real. Many of them joined my intelligence-gathering organization, CAGI, the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence, and began operating in secret, digging out information wherever they worked, wherever they lived, in government, out of government, within law enforcement agencies, within the military, everywhere. And we have put it together piece by piece, point by point, and everyone who has set out to prove me wrong has proved me right. And we have as our guest tonight one of those people, a CAGI member, one of the best researchers in our organization, who has duplicated all of my original research, as have several others. Whenever we assign research projects, or whenever someone volunteers for a research project, we always assign other CAGI members to duplicate the research. In this manner, if one misses something, the other one invariably catches it. On the other end of this phone, ladies and gentlemen, is a man named Paul, who has operated in secret for many months, digging out what you are hearing in this series on treason. It is a duplication of my original research, and he has produced by far the most voluminous amount of material from his documentation of the treason, the destruction of the United States of America, than any other CAGI member to date, although there are other CAGI members working on this material, and some have contributed substantially. Paul, I want to welcome you to the Hour of the Time.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper.
And why don't we start out? I remember, to this day, I don't know if you read my book, did you?
Parts of it. I haven't had time to finish it.
You've been too busy, haven't you?
A little bit, yeah.
Well, I remember sitting at home one day, and you as a CAGI member, of course, had a phone number to be able to reach me at any time that you need to. And you called me at home and said that you had been listening to the Hour of the Time and wanted to find documentation for some of the things that I had put out over the air. And I told you where this documentation was and what it was, and you asked me if I could furnish it to you, and what was my answer, Paul?
Well, we have to dig it up ourselves. And that's the way to do it.
So I told you had to dig it up yourself, and of course nobody ever likes to hear that, but what did you do after that?
Well, I had some trouble trying to find it in the library, and you just kind of guided me along as to, I wasn't aware there was an appendix to the Congressional Record, and you stated that there was, and I went and dug further, and sure enough, it was there.
So most of the people who set out to do research, I know most of the people who have set out to find this voluminous amount of material, have started with the Arms Control and Disarmament Act, and as soon as they got to the paragraph that said that until the law is changed or until there is a treaty made, no provision of this treaty is to be construed to mean the disarmament of the American people, they stopped there. What did you do?
Well, I remember your program last spring with you were discussing the disarmament, and you told the people to go do their homework and look it up, and I went and looked it up, and it's so unbelievable. I kept looking and looking, and I kept digging and digging, and it's unbelievable what's there. And there's a lot more there that we haven't had time to dig up.
That's true. Can you take us sort of step by step? Where did you go, and what did you do, and how did you ultimately find? I remember one conversation we had. You said you'd reached a dead end, and the librarian wasn't too helpful, and I gave you some hints on how to handle the librarian. And did you ever use any of those techniques that I gave you?
Well, definitely, yes. When dealing with librarians, unfortunately, many of them don't know much what's going on in the federal document area. And the nicer a person is, and when you work with the librarian and sometimes suggest things instead of telling them what to do, they are a lot more friendly, and they really will do what they can to find things. And unfortunately, I've had to take things up on my own that they couldn't even find. And it just takes a little common sense and some digging to find things. And it's important to work with the librarians, though, and really show that you appreciate all the work that they're doing and how they're teaching us to find these things, too.
In other words, a little bit of honey goes a long way, doesn't it?
Yeah, a long way.
Do you ever take her a flower or a bag of donuts or something?
Not yet. That library is quite a ways from here. So, and usually it's a different librarian, so it's kind of hard to work that one out. But I do. They do want to have access to the information, and when it's available, they've all been very interested in it. So I'm trying to work with them as soon as we get it available.
So it begins to open their eyes also, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. They had no idea whatsoever.
Actually, no one does. Paul, the biggest reason that I wanted you on the program tonight is because I keep getting from people, well, I'm just one helpless person. I don't have access to the material that you do. I don't know how to do research. And what they're really telling me is, oh, it sounds like work. I'm not going to do that. That's what it translates to in my mind. And I'm not going to let them get away with it. So I wanted you on the show tonight, because when I tell them that every bit of this is in the public domain, and anybody that's got perseverance and is willing to work can dig it out, and you're living proof of that, aren't you?
Yes, I must admit, so it sure helped with all your input with, you know, that disarmament program you did, and, you know, let alone the banking and all the other areas I've worked with. But you also gave Mrs. Smith's address at the end of that program to thank her, and I also dropped her a line and thanked her. And between you and she both, you have walked me through. Some things are, because we don't know much about libraries, hard to find. And, you know, thanks to you and Stan when he was still helping you, and Bernadine. I mean, all three of you have, I probably wouldn't have found half of what I did if it weren't for your help. So, I mean, those guidelines really do help people, and they save a lot of time.
Absolutely. And the program that we did on Bernadine Smith's material, you then, through me, contacted her, and she was able to help you in your research also.
Exactly.
Well, why don't you start out and tell us how you began and what you started to find, and tell us about some of the mileposts, in other words, those times when you just stood there and said, oh, my God. And then what you did next. And also, I want to make a point, folks, that this guy, you know, this isn't the only thing he has to do. This is a very busy, busy person. He attends classes. He has commitments. He has family commitments. Just like everybody, he has a lot of work to do. And really, tell you the truth, when he first started this, he expressed a doubt as to whether he would have the time to do this research or not. And he certainly persevered and made the time, and he didn't have any more free time than I would say probably 95% of all of you listening. So why don't you go ahead and start? I'm just going to turn it over to you, and I'll tell you when the break gets here, and just tell us the whole story.
Well, there's three things I'd like to start out with. First of all, I'd like to thank you for discussing this on Shortwave, because that's the only way I found out about it, okay? And I thank you for that, and your help, and Stan's help, because he helped me. He was still helping you at that time. And secondly, I'd also like to thank your sponsor, Swiss America, for financing your airtime so that, you know, some of us out here are waking up and we are working on doing things about that. And, you know, thirdly, Bernadine, you gave me her address and I contacted her. And between all three of you, I mean, this work wouldn't be where it is right now. So first of all, that's important that, you know, all of you realize how much you helped, and we're in this together. But I remember the first program. On a whim, I picked up the shortwave about a year or so ago, and I don't know how I tuned in, but I tuned in, and one of the nights you were discussing disarmament and that it was all documented and in the federal documents, and it was unbelievable, and I jotted down some things, and my notes were kind of hard to read, and thankfully you ran a rerun. And I taped that one, and I started going to the library to find out if it was true, because you challenged us to do our homework. Well, I didn't want to believe it was true, but if it was, it's something seriously we all better face.
You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. This is the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. You're listening to a series of tapes that originally were broadcast in January of 1994. See, folks, what you've been missing by not listening to the Hour of the Time?
Face it, we're going to regret it. So the local library is pretty small, so I started going to the nearest library that's a federal depository. It's about 25, 30 miles away, and they had some documents, but not many of the older documents. So then I went to a larger city quite a ways away, and they're a major federal depository, and they've had every single document but one. And I just started learning how to use the monthly catalogs and digging up federal doc numbers and SUDOC numbers, and I'd copy everything, and then I'd bring it home. And now when I started compiling this, it's unbelievable. It's all there. It's unbelievable. But the key is we got to wake up and realize this, and when we get this information available, in order to save people time, all the SUDOC numbers are included, all the page numbers, newspaper articles, it's always the page numbers included, the section number. So if anybody wants to confirm it, and it's important that they do confirm it for themselves, this will save them a lot of time in the library so they can get educated and educate other people and start moving ahead and saving our country, because it's getting down to the wire. Yep. And as you get through all this documentation with the public, if they're going to start realizing that if they don't act now, they're going to be staring at some AK-47s to their head. So,
what was the first document you found where you realized that this was, in fact, treason?
I went right in sequence with the way you did the program, and I believe it would have been the Public Light 7297, and then off of that comes the Blueprint for the Peace Race and the State Department document 7277.
And that showed you, in fact, that the United States was operating jointly with the Soviet Union in order to create a one-world government.
Yes, and that they were planning a one-world government under the United Nations, and they were pretty open about it. But the people, from what I have heard, I wasn't even born then, but from the people I've talked to, there was a lot of resistance. The American people did not want this, and that explains one reason why it's so under the rug right now. And it's all there. People would just look, but they're not open about it because they know the American people don't want it, and they wouldn't want it. And it's got to be done in secret, otherwise it wouldn't be happening. But they're getting more and more bold. So after Public Light 7297, a lot of things kind of happened probably through guidance and stuff, but I started finding out where to find out how many times it was voted on and amended. You know, fine, it was passed in 1961, well, is it current now? And through digging and documentation, I got it all the way to the current date as in Supplement 4 of the United States Code, and it's still there, and they've even added to it, and they've even made it a little bit more explicit. So off of that, you know, with the Blueprint for the Peace Race and then 7277, I remember skimming through a section in your book on the One World Government, because, I mean, if anyone sits down and thinks about it, what is the purpose of a complete and total disarmament? The whole purpose is a One World Government. And to most people, that's a new idea. And that's so easily documented, it's unbelievable. It's just we got to know where to look. And that's when I ran into that one problem, finding the appendix from, I believe it was 1955, and different testimony entered into the congressional record openly talking about the a one-world government. And that's when I called you, and you told me there is an appendix. You know, you just got to dig a little bit deeper, and sure enough, it's all there.
Did you ever get mad at me because I wouldn't really give you the answers you wanted to hear but made you go work for it?
No. I've been raised that it's when you do things yourself, it's far better down the road. And I just appreciated how much help you did give, because you know, it's learning how to dig up these documents is something no one can put a price on. I mean, when I go into a library now, 95%, if not more, I can put my finger on it instantly because I know how to find it. And to me, I probably wouldn't have known that if you just would have told me how to get the number. And I appreciate you not telling me.
Well, you're a rare individual, because most people do get angry. But in this process, you have, in fact, become an expert library researcher, and, in fact, are better at finding things in a library than probably 99% of all librarians who do this as a profession for their entire life.
Unfortunately, yes. We would hope our librarians would know. And there are some really good librarians out there, and they really try to help. And
yes, there are, and we certainly don't want to take away from them. There are some excellent librarians out there.
But unfortunately, in that socialist mentality, there's a lot of them who don't care, and they don't have the foggiest idea, and they let you know that, too.
Yeah, and a lot of them are indeed, in fact, socialists, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
And could account for the disappearance of some books from some libraries, although I'm not accusing them of that, because we don't know who, in fact, is removing certain books from libraries. But this is happening across the country. Have you discovered that in your research?
Yes. Every single document I've looked for, I have found. But sometimes you got to come in from a different avenue. And the one main library I do most of my research at, I sent down for the State Department document 7277, and they couldn't find it. I asked the librarian, I said it was an important document, if she could go look, and she went and looked personally twice. And she came back up and she said, all I can tell you is that it was either stolen or it was misshelved. And I thought, well, isn't that a coincidence? But I was able to get that one through library loan, so I just came in from a different angle, and thankfully it wasn't stolen at that library or disappeared. So
now, since then, we've done a library search and found that, as far as we can tell, on the library search computers, it only exists in two libraries in the country at the present time. We are not going to name those libraries because we do not want them to disappear from those libraries. However, it is for sale in the John Birch Society bookstores across the country. So if you have a Birch Society bookstore in your town, you can get a copy of 7277 from them. Or you can just wait until we finish the publication of this entire set of documents. The entire research project will be published as a complete set of documents with total and complete references and sources and everything. I mean, it will be the most incredible evidence of the treasonous destruction of the United States of America that's ever been published in the history of this country. Now, Paul, during your research, you at some point found, as I found many years ago as a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence, that it was not coming to world government, but in fact, the world government was already instituted and in place, and we are subordinate to the United Nations Charter at this time and are, in actual fact, a state of the United Nations. What did you think when you discovered that?
To tell you the honest truth, all of this stuff that I have found and documented and, you know, with your help found, it just, I still shake my head. I know I do believe it because I've gone and I've dug it up and I've copied it and I've read it. It just, it's so unbelievable that some of our political leaders, in fact, most of them, either out of ignorance or just because they believe in this, would sell out our country. I mean, that is really hard to believe, and it's really hard to accept, and that's one of the main reasons I documented this. I mean, this stuff is far out, and I had to go, I mean, dig it up. And if it is true, it's something we got to face up to and be responsible and deal with it and move ahead. And if it isn't, well, so be it. Well, unfortunately, it is true, and I've told you at times, too. There's times when it's just like a dream. You know, I'd wish someone would prove me wrong, and I'd wish someone would say, wake up. You know, it's just a dream, and unfortunately, it's not.
That's right, it's not. And all of this documentation comes right out of the Congressional Record, right out of the United States Code Books, right out of the records of the United Nations, right out of the newspapers of the world, right out of State Department documentation. This is not conjecture at all. It is actual fact. And according to the Executive and Judicial Department interpretation of Article 6 of the United States Constitution, the United States of America, in fact, does not exist anymore, but is a state of the United Nations under the United Nations Charter, and they are, in fact, in the process of disarming all nations of the world to bring into reality their one-world totalitarian socialist state.
And one interesting thing I'd like to throw in, and that it's very clear in the State Department document 7277, word for word, it states specifically that the states, meaning the country and armies, will be reduced, and they cannot. Their forces will be reduced in such a small number where there is no way they can challenge the UN army. And that is a serious thing that the people must realize, is that if we do have somewhat of a military left, it is only for policing at a national level, and not challenge the UN in any form.
Yeah, and the real reason for the for it will be to police us.
Yes.
In fact, not to protect us from some outside force, but to subordinate us to the United Nations dictates.
And one interesting thing too about the United Nations that I don't know how many people really realize this. I wasn't aware of it until I started reading this, but when this is compiled, you'll get copies of it, we hear a lot about human rights, which is one of the United Nations conventions or charters and treaties. And what's interesting is if a person would read the Human Rights Convention, right from the United Nations, which was co-authored with Mrs. Roosevelt, and also read the Russian Constitution, they will find that many of the articles are word for word.
And absolutely word for word.
And that's what the people have to realize, is that a one world government under the UN is welcome to the Fourth Reich. I mean, it's cut and dried, and I'm trying to get my hands right now on the new Russian Constitution to compare it to the old one and the UN human rights, and when we get that compiled, you know, we'll get it available through you and stuff. But the people have to realize, I mean, if they sat down and read the United Nations Charter, it has nothing to do with our Bill of Rights. It's exactly opposite of our Bill of Rights. And I just received in the mail today Boutros Ghali's book, An Agenda for Peace, right from the United Nations. And we'll have to try and get that available with the documentation, because it's unbelievable. He said the League of Nations unfortunately failed, and now, you know, we're going to do it through the United Nations. I mean, they're pretty clear as to what they're doing.
That's right. And folks, old Mr. Tom Valentine tried to make you not listen to me by trying to connect me with UFOs. The truth is Tom Valentine wanted me to talk about UFOs in his show, and it wasn't until I linked UFOs to the New World Order that he all of a sudden cut me off and said that he wasn't going to continue with me on the second hour. That's what scared Mr. Valentine, because Mr. Valentine is involved in this. If you listen to his show long enough, you'll see that he is covering up the real information that you need to know, and that you will only hear on the Hour of the Time, nowhere else. Paul, what else can you go into that can enlighten people out there? Are there any shortcuts in research, any things that you found that people normally would not know where to look, that that they can go and will help them find information faster?
Well, if a person has a federal SUDOT number, that will save hours and hours of time.
Okay, now why don't you explain to us exactly what that is?
Well, according to the federal documents, every federal government document from the United States Government Printing Office has a federal SUDOC. The Library of Congress has its own number, so the SUDOC number doesn't do much good, but you can find, the librarians usually can help you find the Library of Congress number. But in all the other libraries with federal which are federal depositories, you can simply, with the SUDOC number, go to the federal depository area and give them that SUDOC number, and they will pull up the document instantly for you.
Great. Now, hold on, though, because we got to take a break. Okay, Paul, can you continue where you left off?
Sure. When we were talking about the Federal Food Act numbers, the key issue is that the library is not a federal depository, and you can ask any librarian if your local library is. If it isn't, though, all you need is that Federal Food Act number, and you give them the number and the title with it, and they will transfer that document in. Either they will copy it for you, or they will transfer it in where you can copy it or study it. So that's why when I compiled all this, every single page has the Federal Food Act number or a state stat or a federal stat number. And, you know, newspaper articles, I got to the point where I get leads from different people, or I'd see copies of different so-called Patriot stuff, and it was rather annoying because they never gave page numbers and usually just dates. And unfortunately, I did find a lot of typographical errors, and there are some documents that I never did find. And
there are in fact a lot of documents floating around the Patriot community that are frauds. Isn't that correct?
That's what I would say, yes. And unless people go document it themselves, they'll never know if they're being deceived or if they know what's actually going on. And that's why when we get this available, it's the page number, the section number, everything is included, so anyone can go look it up themselves and find it. Now, there's one thing is if you want to go look up any type of federal document, and there's thousands of them out there, and they're still being published currently, is there's a government publication called the Monthly Catalog. Some of these are published just monthly, and you'll find them in the library monthly in a paper soft cover. Some of the libraries, the larger libraries, will actually bind these into books, usually by year, bi-yearly. It depends how many, how fat the books are for each month. But if you want to look up, like, State Department 7277, you simply look up the title in the monthly catalog in the index. And sometimes you gotta dig and look under different subject headings, but you should probably find that one under Freedom for More. But you're not going to find it the date that, as of it was released September 1961. You probably won't find it until October or November, sometimes even 5 months later in the monthly catalog. So sometimes it takes some digging through different monthly catalogs, finding that actual federal document as to when it was printed in the monthly catalog. And in the monthly catalog, you will be given the Federal Food Act number. And from there, you simply show the librarian that number, and they'll pull up the document, or they'll transfer it in from another library. And not all libraries will have the monthly catalog, so you'll have to find a library that has the monthly catalog where you can look it up, or, you know, all this documentation that we'll make available, they won't even need access to monthly catalogs. They'll just have a doc number, and they can send it in through library loan or whatever, and it'll save hours and hours of time. And unfortunately, it's rather annoying when, not on your end, Bill, but on other people's end, that they would have certain citations, and they don't exist. No, either it's a typographical error, or it's an honest mistake, or it's an intentional mistake, and you never know unless you go dig it up. And that's crucial, especially with a lot of these far-fetched ideas coming out in the so-called Patriots.
Yeah. Did you ever go look for one document that I ever cited that was not in existence?
Let's see. Did I ever run that by me one more time?
Did you ever hear me cite a document on this show or in my book and go look for that document and not be able to find it?
No. Every single document that you have talked about, I have been able to find.
I want to take a moment here to talk to the audience for just a second. Many of you faxed us newspaper articles, information, newsletters. Some of you send this stuff through the mail. And I've got to tell you right now, anything that we get that does not specifically state the source, the location, the page, the section, all of these things that we're talking about here, we never use. You're wasting your time if you send us something that we cannot find. If you just send us a page with writing on it, or you clip out an article in a paper and you don't write the name of the paper, the date that the paper came out on, the page that this article appeared on, or the section and the page of the newspaper, it just goes into the trash can because we can't use it. Everything that's ever sent to us, we farm out to a CAGI member, or else I do the research myself, or Carolyn does it. and it must be duplicated by us so that we know it's genuine before we ever use it. If you are not willing to do that for us when you send these things to us, then don't bother sending them. Recently, I got several pages Xeroxed from a book. Whoever sent these pages to us had very carefully cut out the page numbers and the name of the book on the pages before he sent them. Why he would ever do that, I don't know. However, since I've read The Two Babylons, I recognize that these were pages from the book The Two Babylons. And since we have the book, we didn't need it. But why would anybody do something like that? Why would anybody send us information that would not reference the source? Well, folks, sometimes it's because you don't know to do that, and you think you're doing us a favor. And sometimes it's a completely fraudulent document with the intention of getting me to use it in order to discredit William Cooper, Kaji, and the Hour of the Time. It'll never work, because if we can't duplicate the research, folks, it's never used by Kaji, by William Cooper, or by the Hour of the Time. Paul, you recently took a trip. Where'd you go?
I was in Washington, D.C.
You were in the mouth of the beast.
Got it.
And did you have some interesting experiences while you were there?
Yeah, very interesting.
Would you like to recount some of the more interesting?
Yeah. I'd like to throw one other thing out real quick on the research and stuff. What still I find astonishing is that I did rather well in school, and I went to a private school, thankfully, because my parents sacrificed for that. But what surprises me is I have not met one person to this day who knows what exists in the libraries and how to find it in person. And I find it so fascinating that there are thousands of government documents. They have years and years of government documents on weather control and all these different subjects that exist. And that astonishes me that we were never taught any of this in school. And I find that very interesting. And it was really frustrating at first. I remember one of the first nights I was in the library, and I used my calling card, and I called Stan, and I asked him. I said, you know, I'm having difficulty finding this, because we had the newer United States Code. And he told me, he said, look in Title 22, and he kind of walked me through it. And sure enough, it was there. But at first, it was really frustrating. It was a lot of hard work. But I believe we have to know what's going on, and we have to have the facts when we talk to people. And the more a person works with it, the easier it gets to be. And now, most things I can walk in and just put my finger on things pretty easily. But ironically, in Washington, and this is nothing against the librarians at the Library of Congress, but there are some exceptional librarians there. Unfortunately, they don't work every day. But it was really interesting in the law library section. I was asking them actually what is a charter and how it's issued by Congress and what are the rules and how a person can find that, and they didn't know. And that's something I had to pursue on my own, and I had another lead from a friend, and I have to go through the Judiciary Committee on that. But it's just because a person may not find the answer they're looking for at that time, you got to come in from on different angles, different perspectives, and you got to keep digging until you find it, or until you prove that whatever lead you're going on is not an accurate lead. And that was interesting, and it was interesting too as everything was shut down conveniently for the weather. And there, up here, we just had a week of 35 below, and it's cold. But down there, they're a bunch of socialists. They're more than willing to get a free day off. But when we were down there, we paid a little visit to the House of the Temple, which is ironically 13 blocks directly north of the White House and in a perfect square with Washington's obelisk with Capitol. And it's a very interesting building. And
now, many of our listeners don't know what you're talking about. Some of them are new listeners. Just exactly what is the House of the Temple, Paul?
The House of the Temple is the head building of the Supreme Council of the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of the 33rd Degree. And I didn't know it existed. I lived out in Washington for a while, and until I started tuning into you, I had no idea what the secret societies were, and obviously the Masons, and I didn't even know that place existed until I ran into someone who said that, and I made it a point to visit there the next time I went to Washington, and we did visit. And ironically, when you see the outside of the building, there are two sphinxes in front. One has its eyes wide open, and one has its eyes semi-closed or semi-open, and According to the tour guide, they're symbolic of power and knowledge, and you can't have one without the other and vice versa. And the temple is shaped...
Now, wait a minute. Did you hear that, folks? Power and knowledge, and you can't have one without the other. My people perish for lack of knowledge. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, and you'll notice that the temple is shaped at the top. It's a pyramid without a capstone on it, but there's 33 columns on the outside, and they're all 33 feet tall. And the walls, as you go in the temple, on the front door, on the knocker, is a lion's head, okay, on each door. And as you go in, the walls are 8 feet thick of solid marble. I believe it's marble or granite. 8 feet solid thick. And what's interesting is as you go in there, the tour guide had an interesting comment. He said that what the Masons teach is freedom of thought, freedom of speech, and freedom of action, which is an interesting freedom that's added.
That's right.
Very interesting, because you and when your guest, Ralph Epperson, A. Ralph Epperson, were on, you very clearly pointed out the freedom of action. And as you go in, they will... they're willing to let you take photographs. They're willing to let you actually do a movie or video camera. There's one room they won't let you do that in, and that's J. Edgar Hoover's room, who was a 33rd degree and a Knights Templar, and among other things. But they show different pictures of major people who are Masons, and the symbology, they come across like they're a very benevolent group, and I've documented in Albert Pike's book, Morals and Dogma. He has his own special room there, and his body is buried at the temple.
That's right, his body. General Christopher Albert Pike is buried in the house of the temple.
Exactly. And what's interesting is I did find Morals and Dogma at a library, but conveniently some of the pages have been cut out. But beside the point, after, it's very clear that the first 3 degrees, he's very clear in his book about that. They don't know what's going on. And the tour guide and the few Masons I meet, they come across like they're a very benevolent, charitable organization. And if a person didn't know the secret underlying truth as to what the 33rd degrees and higher know, they probably would be awestruck with the whole temple. But thankfully, the symbology is everywhere. The serpents, as you look on the outside of the temple, looking in on three sides, you'll see the rising sun with the double-headed eagle, which is the new symbol of coat of arms for Russia. It's on their new coins, the double-headed eagle. And you'll also see the serpents. What's fascinating inside, sometime, Bill, maybe you should have someone go and do a video, and then you can make that available, like the Hotel Luxor,
yeah.
Yeah, because I think people, I mean, it confirms everything that you've said about the secret societies, but one of the most astonishing things is no matter where we turn, we keep finding these people. They were rather excited because they have a Masonic apron, and it's a very special Masonic apron. The picture that we see of the man standing on the moon in the spacesuit, he is conveniently holding this Masonic apron.
Now, wait a minute. Let's go back. Which photograph are you talking about?
I'd have to... I'm trying to remember which one. If he's just standing there facing, you know, the viewer.
Is he holding the flag or anything?
I don't recall if he's holding the flag. All I know is he pointed out he was holding the Masonic apron, and you can see it clearly in the photograph, the square and the compass, if you look, and that's what blew me away, so I didn't even notice. All I know is it was... You know, when I grew up in school, that is the common picture we saw of the man standing on the moon. And what floored me was his letter was there. He's a 33rd degree Mason, and I'm not familiar with, that was before my time. And if you mention the name, I'm sure I can tell you exactly who it was. He had a letter there. He was a 33rd degree Mason, and I don't know what the big deal was. Maybe they exposed it to the moon atmosphere or something, but it's clearly visible in the picture, and they have it on display, the picture showing this, and they have the actual apron there, too. They also have President Bush's, some of his cufflinks with Vice President Quayle. They had a couple letters from Mrs. Bush. Albert Pike has his own room, just like J. Edgar Hoover, and he supposedly has over 400 or 500 actual writings or works, and morals and dogma were everywhere in that room. The library is open to the public, and the library is just loaded with Masonic literature, and anyone can go read this stuff and find it for themselves. It's clear. And
now, can you imagine how much power they had in the United States and in the world with J. Edgar Hoover, a 33rd degree Freemason, hand-picking the agents for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, digging up dirt on all the people in office throughout this country, and then paying them a visit and telling them, hey, we got this, this, and this on you, and if you don't go along with us, you're sunk.
And you wonder how Washington is controlled. If they don't have dirt on you, they'll get dirt on you. Imagine being invited to the home of a very prominent and wealthy man, and then being shown to the library to wait until the person you're coming in to meet is available. And so you sit there alone in the library or the parlor. And then all of a sudden, a door opens, and two naked women run in, sit on your lap, and a photographer snaps a picture, or the whole thing is videotaped secretly. Do you think anybody's going to believe you when you tell them the truth? Of course not. It's very easy. It's very easy to either dig up dirt or manufacture dirt on anyone and blackmail them, ladies and gentlemen. Also, while the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, J. Edgar Hoover, chartered a Masonic lodge just for the agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Now, we know that happened because it has been revealed throughout the years that that's exactly what J. Edgar Hoover did. And this, ladies and gentlemen, accounts for a lot of the actions of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in recent years. And with Randy Weaver, with Gordon Call, up on Whidbey Island, with the MOVE Group, with the Sibianese Liberation Army, which, by the way, was created in a mind control experiment in the prison system in California, which was documented, folks, by the Napa Sentinel. And the most recent debacle, the massacre at Waco, Texas. What else did you find, Paul?
You can add to that the Oklahoma City bombing and the shootings at the schools and shopping centers and McDonald's around the country. And you can expect a lot more of it.
At the Masonic Temple or at the Library of Congress? Or
anything.
I did find a couple books at the Library of Congress with the 13th Amendment stated word for word. They were in the rare book collection, and I mean, it's all...
So they have, in fact, taken the real 13th Amendment from the Constitution and substituted it with something else.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that, you know, the problem I have with that is the Constitution, in my eyes, is the highest document in the land, and it's nothing to be tampered with. And all the research we've dug up on that, it sure looks like it's been tampered with. And what's fascinating is very few, if any, of us know anything about it.
That's right. These people are, in fact, traitors.
Exactly. And that people have to realize they better look up the word treason, and they better learn. When I grew up, I used to respect Americans for having a backbone and standing up for what's right and being brave and courageous. And all I can say is they better look up the word treason, and they better start realizing which politicians, and I've talked with a lot of them personally, and there are very few, unfortunately, that are on our side. They know exactly what's going on, and they've been part of it. I mean, in the documentation, you'll find the most current records we have found on the updates on Public Law 7297, which is talking about a complete and total disarmament. Conveniently, some of the voting records don't exist, but the people better realize how their own representatives in the House and Senate are voting on these things and make them accountable. And if they're selling out the country, get them out of office and get some decent people in, because this is flat-out treason, and they're getting so bold. And as, you know, you go through all this documentation, Bill, the people are going to start realizing how bold they are. a lot of these newspaper articles, I got leads from other people, and some of them I just ran across skimming through the papers, and they are very bold. I just mentioned to you, it's on its way. Front page, Washington Times, December 15th. The new Army manual that comes out next month shows our troops literally under the United Nations. And it's about time people realize that, you know, our troops in Desert Storm, Desert Shield, whatever they want to call it, there were no insignias on those vehicles.
Desert Scam is the real word.
There you go. That's exactly what it was. And I have George Bush's exact quote from the weekly compilation. I just got that, where he said that Desert Storm, that whatever war you want to call it, that was implementing the New World Order. Word for word from a government printing office document. And the people, I mean, the documentation is all available. The key is now we got to start moving ahead and start realizing the traitors, they have to be taken out of office. And, you know, we're not, if they're scared about doing that, they better realize, they better reflect back on Russia and communism and socialism. They better understand what it is in their mind, and they better start reading Gorbachev's own book called Perestroika, which some of it's in the documentation, where he is openly a socialist, he is openly a communist, and he just happens to have an office on the Presidio, the oldest running military base in the United States in San Francisco. And anyone can go get his phone number out of the library. They can write him and find out who's on his board, which is interesting. It's a bunch of congressmen, ex-congressmen.
Uh-huh.
And
ex-high officials of the United States government, I might add.
Yes, very high.
And he is listed as an official advisor to the President of the United States of America. And in his book, he states, don't be fooled by the dissolution of the Soviet Union.
One interesting comment I might add, when you get into the State Department document with that, when Gorbachev and Reagan signed the INF Treaty,
uh-huh.
You'll find in the fine print there that Mr. Schultz even says he read Gorbachev's book.
That's right.
So he's very aware of what's going on.
That's right.
And he's conveniently on the advisory board. But the people better realize, I mean, Gorbachev is more than clear and open as to what he's doing. It's the One World Order, and that if they think this is painful, well, they better project themselves into the future, into a socialist, communist,
that's right,
police state. And if this is heaven compared to what they're going to start facing down the future. And I'm not raining on anybody's parade. When they start reading the actual government documents and start digging for themselves, it's a rude awakening, but it's true, and we got to wake up.
I want to thank you very much for being our guest tonight. I want to thank you so much for all the work that you've done, most of it unsung in libraries, at tables late at night, and the sweat that you've put in for this country, I think is going to go a long way to help liberate us.
For our Bill of Rights.
Right. Ladies and gentlemen, form your militia units. There will be no political solution to this, ladies and gentlemen, and you will not find relief in the court. Vladimir Lenin, the founder of the Soviet Union, defined peace as the elimination of all opposition to socialism. You better wake up. Let's continue with where we left off. Yesterday at the end of the early show, and I was reading an article from the Congressional Record of the Senate, And let me see. This was from page 1962, page 3217, Congressional Record of the Senate. And I'll back up just a little bit so you get the gist of what this was all about. In the first phase, all nuclear weapons tests by nations would be prohibited, production of fissionable material stopped, strategic delivery systems reduced, and conventional arms and armed forces would be cut. In the second phase, present stocks of nuclear weapons would be reduced. Further cuts would be made in armed forces, armaments, and delivery systems, and military bases and facilities would be dismantled. At the same time, a peace force would be established for the United Nations. A peace force would be established for the United Nations. In the third and final phase, all nations would possess only those forces, non-nuclear armaments and establishments required for the purpose of maintaining internal order. Of maintaining internal order, not defending us. They would also support and provide agreed manpower for a United Nations peace force.
Ladies and gentlemen, you must understand, if you've studied the history of socialism and communism, that the need for an internal force to maintain internal order has always been necessary in those systems, because the threat is always revolution. The threat is always revolution when the people discover what it is, what it really means, what kind of life they have under socialism and or communism. And remember, as you continue to hear our nation referred to as a democracy, B.I. Lenin and Karl Marx both said that democracy is indispensable to socialism. They both said that democracy leads to socialism. They both said that the ultimate goal of socialism is communism. You'd better wake up, folks, and you'd better do it damn fast.
Also support and provide agreed manpower for a United Nations peace force. This force would be fully functioning and would be sufficiently strong to overpower any individual nation or combination of nations resisting its will.
And that is the truth of what is happening in Yugoslavia. And remember, there were no refugees until NATO began bombing. The Rambouillet Accord was not an accord. There were no meetings. There were no discussions. There were no sit-down anything regarding Rambouillet. Madeleine Albright presented it as an ultimatum to both sides. Sign it, or we will bomb you into the Stone Age. In that treaty, it specifies that the entire nation of Yugoslavia will be handed over to NATO forces to do with as they will. If you don't believe it, get it and read it. Yugoslavia could never have signed such an accord. No nation could ever have signed such an accord. The United States of America would never sign such an accord. Even Apache County wouldn't sign any such accord.
You understand what I just read to you, ladies and gentlemen, right out of the Congressional Record of the Senate. Let me read it again. Should you have wax in your ears or some other obstruction between you and your radio? This force would be fully functioning and would be sufficiently strong to overpower any individual nation or combination of nations resisting its will. There you have it. 1, 2, 3, bingo! The United Nations rules the world. And who rules the United Nations? That is the question. For if one moment old Nikita thinks he isn't going to rule the UN, you can bet your last kopeck he's not going to fall for a trap like this. As soon as he and Mr. Nehru, Mr. Nkrumah, Mr. Sukarno, and a few other scoundrels count enough votes to come up with a winning combination, such a proposal will be a natural for them, and there won't be any more kopecks left for us to count. That's the beauty of the system from Mr. Khrushchev's point of view. Of course, it's heads he wins, tails we lose. And speaking of votes, one of the most interesting, if most frightening, aspects of this proposal is the lineup on an 18-nation negotiating body in the United Nations, which soon will be considering this disarmament scheme.
You will all remember, ladies and gentlemen, that Khrushchev took off his shoe and banged it on the desk at a meeting of the United Nations, where he told the United States of America in no uncertain terms, we don't have to invade you. We don't have to bring an army over here. We don't even have to bomb you. You will be destroyed from within. And then he said those chilling words, we will bury you. He was telling the truth because he knew that old tail gunner McCarthy was right. And since they vilified McCarthy and made anyone who looks for socialists and communists in government the villain, they have infiltrated our government. They have taken over our government. They are destroying it from within. They are in control.
Originally, this committee was composed of 5 Western nations, Britain, Canada, France, Italy, and the United States, and 5 Soviet bloc nations, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Romania, and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. But the sharp division of these 2 factions resulted in a complete deadlock, and on June 27, 1960, the Soviets walked out. Then somebody came up with the bright idea of adding 8 independent nations to the committee as a compromise. 2 Asian, 2 African, 2 Latin American, 1 Middle Eastern, and 1 European. The future of this country and of the free world may very well depend upon how those 8 nations line up. At the moment, the future is looking very dark. For from Asia, they picked Burma and India. From Africa, Nigeria and Ethiopia. From Latin America, Mexico and Brazil. Egypt from the Middle East and Sweden from Europe. 5 of these nations, a clear majority, recently voted in favor of seating Red China in the United Nations and kicking Chiang out. These 5 nations are Burma, Egypt, Ethiopia, India, and Sweden. Moreover, Mexico is the only Latin American nation, other than Cuba, of course, to oppose flatly a resolution by the Organization of American States calling for a foreign ministers' conference on the Cuban threat of communist invasion of the hemisphere. Brazil, which refused to support this same measure by abstaining on the vote, has already proclaimed its disapproval of any measures which the foreign ministers might take to deal with Castro. The Brazilian government has officially called upon the United States and other hemisphere nations to coexist with Cuban communism. How many friends does this leave the United States on the all-important United Nations Disarmament Committee? You count them. I'm sick. From Mr. Clark. Readers of the record will note that my distinguished colleague made certain statements to which I take strong dissent. First, he said, every day more and more people share a growing concern for the preoccupation of the State Department and some people in high places with the issue of disarmament. Second, he said, I think it is naive and unrealistic to be preoccupied with the question of disarmament.
And we're going to leave it right there, folks. We'll continue on Monday night, and I will back it up to the beginning of Mr. Clark's recitation in Congress. And I hope that you think long and hard about what you've been listening to over the weekend. Do you want to live under a totalitarian socialist world government where there is no Bill of Rights, where there is no protection for the individual, that the sacrifice of the individual for the betterment of the group is the law of the land, and that you might be given some privileges, but privileges can be taken away as quickly as they are handed out? And remember the United Nations resolution that makes it okay to be a member of any religion as long as that religion is legal. The United Nations has only approved 1 religion in its history, and that is the Baha'i Faith. I suggest you look it up and see what it is, because you're going to be amazed at what the New World Religion turns out to be. Good night, folks. God bless each and every single one of you. And God bless America. Ladies and gentlemen, there is a prophecy in the Mormon Church, which many Mormon patriots are fond of quoting to me. Of course, they're good people, good, solid American patriots who believe in the family, in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the great principles and ideals upon which this nation was based. But they don't know how far, to what level we have sunk. They say that at some future date, when the Constitution is hanging by a thread, the Mormon Church will come forward to save it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's not just hanging by a thread. It's gone for all intents and purposes. My question is this: where is the Mormon Church? Has its hierarchy sold out to the New World Order? I think you'd better be asking your church officials that question. And cite these documents. And if you need a set, they're on sale right now for $64. You can purchase them from us, and I'll give you that information on Monday night. They're normally... They're normally much higher than that. Much, much higher than that. Represent years and years and years of research of many people. It's over 620 some odd official government documents proving the treason that is occurring in this country. The destruction of the greatest, most promising, best, freest people that have ever lived upon the face of this earth is staring us in the face. You had better wake up. You'd better do it very quickly.